Well, hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Ecclesia Leadership Podcast. This is John Chandler. I'm sitting in Austin, Texas, where we know no such thing as winter or apparently spring because it's 80. We always talk about the weather, don't we, Matt? Because you and I have really boring weather. With me is Matt Alexander in Miami, Florida.
Yes, hello. And it's been, it started to warm up a little bit here as well. Usually winters in Miami are pretty awesome in the 70s and very low key, but it's gotten a little bit more humid and it's probably in the low 80s, I would imagine. So I don't have any room to complain, but putting it out there.
Unless you're an Eskimo, maybe.
Right.
So enough about us. That's all we need from you and I.
Perfect.
We are with patiently waiting for us to get through all this weather talk is Mandy Smith. Hi, Mandy.
Hi.
Mandy, how's the weather in Cincinnati?
It's glorious.
Yeah?
It's pretty 65 and sunny, and life is made for days like this in Cincinnati.
Yeah? Is that unusual this time of year, or is that about right?
It happens at this time of year, but there's also a lot of other stuff that happens at this time of year, so
right.
I live for these days. I was telling somebody this morning that this day, you know, the sunny day where it's a little chilly in the morning but warm by midday, is like the harshest winter day that I knew when I was a child. So, it's funny that it's different now, but I appreciate them.
That's why even when it's 65, not that anybody else can see this, but you're wearing a scarf.
Yes.
That looks more stylistic, though, than...
It's very light.
Yes. Yes. Well, we haven't even said, Mandy, we are fresh off the Ecclesia National Gathering of 2016, where University Christian Church is now officially prayed in and welcomed
yes.
to the Ecclesia Network. So welcome.
Thank you.
And what we'd really like to do today is just hear a little bit of the story of University Christian. So why don't you just launch into that? Maybe tell us, I know you didn't start University Christian. You came on the scene. So many of the conversations we have here are with people who started the church,
mm-hmm.
but you were at a church, I think, that has a much longer heritage than a typical Ecclesia church. So
yeah,
would love to hear maybe a little bit of the story of the church, but maybe even more so what it looks like now, how you've come
sure.
into it.
Yeah. The church was started about 26 years ago with a mission to be both a neighborhood church and a campus ministry, which the founders were told was impossible. And I understand why. It does have its challenges, but it also brings so much opportunity. And they started meeting in they moved YMCA and a community center. And then about 17, 18 years ago, I think, bought their first building. I actually started attending when the church was just 1 year old, when I was a student myself.
Wow.
And so I've been able to be a part of the community for a long time, on and off. You know, I moved in and out of town a couple of times, but it's been great to be a part of the longer history of the community. I started on staff about 8 years ago now as an associate pastor, which was primarily organizing Sunday mornings and volunteers and doing a little bit of discipleship. And then the lead pastor and I set up a way to co-lead. He was stepping into more kind of justice work outside of the church. And then that just really drew him in. So we figured out a way for him to step into that full time. And I stepped into the lead role about 3 years ago. So it's a really, honestly, I often say that this particular congregation has healed my own imagination of what the church can be. It's not perfect by any means, but it's quite a vibrant place. There's, you know, we're right by the university campus, and in a kind of a very walkable neighborhood with lots of restaurants and shops right next door. And we do have a traditional church building. That, you know, it has a steeple and it has stained glass, but then one wall of that building kind of opens up into what used to be the fellowship hall and a campus house, which is now our cafe, which has become about 12, 13 years ago, we opened that cafe, and it's just become a hub of the local community. You know, as you can imagine, students come and study in there all day long. They buy one cheap cup of coffee and use our Wi-Fi all day. And then, you know, there's all kinds of arts events and music, and people do their recitals there and all kinds of great stuff that we have opportunities to be a part of the community. And so I love the fact that our sanctuary and our community space, so to speak, are not really distinct. There are cafe things that go on in the church sanctuary, and there are church things that go on in the cafe. And so it kind of blurs some of those sacred secular lines, and it just opens up so many amazing conversations and connections with folks. It just makes it really organic. I remember being in at ministry events where people were saying, we have to get out of our buildings and get into the community, folks. And I just remember thinking one time, why do I not really feel drawn to do that? And I realized, well, the community is inside our building. They count our building as part of the community. And in fact, sometimes we can't find a place to have a staff meeting because there's so many rooms that are being used by community groups. So that's a wonderful thing. I love the kind of vitality that comes with that. What else do I need to tell you? We have an interesting mix, probably about 50% students. And of course, they're just constantly coming and going.
Sure.
Which we've just kind of learned. I think when my kids move out, I'm going to have that place in my heart that's already been prepared because I feel like I'm doing that constantly. Mm-hmm. And we have to choose not to harden our hearts to new people coming in, even though we know they're going to leave us in a couple of years. We've chosen to embrace that as part of our call, of course, to be sending people off with joy, even though our hearts are breaking every single graduation. So we have that wonderful ongoing stream of students coming and going. But then we have a lot of young adults and young families and even middle-aged older folks as well. We had prayed for more of that to just have some stability so that we could continue in a sustainable way to serve the community. And so it's a really great mix. And when school's out, we probably have about 150 people who are here all year round, and then the students fill up the rest when school is in. And let me think, what else is really pressing for us? We're from restoration movement background, which is kind of the non-denominational before there was non-denominational. And so it gives us a lot of freedom. Each church is independent. So we kind of have an evangelical thing happening, but also a lot of liturgical kinds of elements, and we have an opportunity to live out one of the values of the restoration movement, which I know is not unique to us, the whole in essentials unity and in a non-essentials liberty and in all things love. When you're by a campus where there are so many different worldviews, you don't have the luxury really to bicker among ourselves as Christians, and so it does force us to focus on what's truly essential to our faith. And so within the church community, there's Quakers and Catholics and Pentecostals and people from all different backgrounds, a lot of people recovering from church baggage.
Yeah.
But it really forces us to focus on communion and Jesus and the Bible and baptism and kind of central things. And we'd love to have conversations about all the non-essential stuff, but for the most part, it doesn't become a bone of contention because we just there are so many other perspectives right around us and in our building that to spend energy on Christian infighting would just be a waste of time.
Yeah. So it's working then. You can't have 50% college students and 50% neighborhood. You guys have proven that wrong.
Yes, but
so
it's...
So why did it work? Why is it working? Work.
That I can only say, I mean, the Spirit, you know, because it is a huge challenge. It means that there's a lot more weight on the staff to be the constant ones and a lot more weight on the regular folks to be really strong and committed. And it also means that younger adults get to be in leadership positions way before they would in another church. We did a survey one time and the average age of our eldership at that time was 33 because we just didn't have many other, they were the old folks, you know?
Yeah.
So, one of the things that's beautiful about it is that it forces, well, it doesn't force, it creates an environment for students that is kind of like home, where they're with people of different ages. They're helping babysit somebody's kids. And there's a couple of families who have kind of an arrangement with students where they bring them over for dinner and let them do their laundry while they're there. And then they're the go-to babysitters when the family needs babysitters. So we try to encourage that kind of a relationship, that we really need each other. And students are at such a time of transition in so many ways that to have people who are a few years ahead of them who are somewhat stable in their lives is just such a blessing. But yeah, it does have its challenges.
I remember my freshman year of college being invited over to one of the faculty members' houses for dinner. Probably it was November or December. And I remember sitting in there and just looking around going, I haven't been inside of a house in 4 months.
Oh, wow.
You know? So yeah, what you described, there's so much opportunity for that. And I think so beneficial for college students to still be part of normal life, quote unquote, normal life, I'm saying.
Yeah, we're just starting to name a certain kind of pain that we experience from people. And we mostly experience it with students and with young adults in different ways. But we've realized how in some ways we kind of run a homeless shelter without it being a homeless shelter. You know, these people have homes where they live, but they feel so homeless. Whether it's students who are coming to college for the first time or young adults who are establishing a home and family away from their extended family. We have so many people who've done that. And I imagine if you were running an actual homeless shelter, there would be people coming to you with particular needs, telling you what their hungers were, and you would have to stop and say, is that really what your hunger is? I can't actually say yes to that hunger, you know, if it's for drugs or whatever. And there's a certain amount of work that those people would have to do to have the courage to say, what you think you want is not what you want. And even though you might hate me for it, or I might look unsuccessful for offering you something different, there's a different story and here's what I can offer you. And we have so many of those conversations. We as a staff have just been recently naming how much we feel like failures or people get frustrated with us because they're just so hungry to just quickly have a quick fix of belonging. And obviously that's something that takes time and involves investment. And so to shape actually what we can offer people and to provide that for them in a way that's healthy is good, but it takes a lot of work to even figure out what that is. Because I think that human beings don't actually have the skills to create extended family kind of communities. I think that for this, all of human history, those things have just naturally happened when we've lived where we've always lived. And now that people are so mobile, we still long for those things, but we don't actually have the skills to find those things because they've always just happened, you know. And so we're at a stage in history right now where we have to actually be really conscious about how do I make friends and how do I find people to call when my baby's sick in the middle of the night and I need a ride to the hospital or whatever. So I know a lot of churches at the moment are kind of going through that process, and that's part of what we're doing too.
Is Cincinnati a pretty transient city?
Actually, not in general. I think there are a lot of folks who like live down the street from where their parents live. But around the university, it's very much the case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to ask Mandy, tell us a little bit more about Cincinnati and the context and the campus and all that kind of thing.
It's a good sized city. I think the greater Cincinnati area, which includes parts of Northern Kentucky, is about 2 million people. It's been kind of industrial in the past, but doing what I think a lot of Midwestern cities are doing, having this kind of renewal, urban renewal kind of thing happening, bit of gentrification going along with that. But some real genuine kind of creative energy and younger people being drawn to the city in new ways. And our university setting is in uptown, which is right beside downtown. So we are in an urban setting in the center of the city, but also with this huge university there. So that's an interesting dynamic for us. So we have all of the diversity and the, you know, urban crime kinds of issues that go along with that as well as the university context. Cincinnati, I think, is a bit of a mix. It's got some really traditional German and Italian Catholic background. But then there's an interesting, amazing arts scene. So it's an interesting city. Right around the campus, like I said, there's it's kind of an urban setting. UC campus, I think, I haven't seen the statistics lately. I can tell just by how hard it is to get a parking spot that it's growing a lot. I think they have about 40,000 students now. So it's a pretty big campus, and I know the president, Sandra Ono, has done a lot of amazing things. He's actually a member of InterVarsity, so that's pretty cool to have a university president who is a Christian. What else can I tell you about? Were there particular questions about that that you were looking for?
No, not necessarily. Just, just to get a fuller perspective kind of on
one thing that's Cincinnati interesting to me. Cincinnati has one of the highest childhood poverty rates in the nation, and also a lot of racial tension, which was really, has taken me a long time to figure out, because I didn't grow up with that kind of a dynamic. There's the huge Appalachian population, an African American population, and then a lot of Guatemalans too. And so there's all these different dynamics that come with all of that as well, which, you know, is humbling to try to figure out the different stories and how they intersect.
So you said that you started at the church attending like a year after it started. Have you been there that whole time?
Let me think. I was there for 6 years when I was a student. Then we left to go to England for 3 years, and then came back again for a while, and then left again for a different ministry. So I probably attended the church for, I don't know, 15, 18 years, something like that.
So when you moved back that final time, was that for you to work at the church, or were you attending the church again? And then that
we were attending again.
Role?
Yeah, we
so how had did that been, come about for you. How did you have imaginations to be in, pastoral ministry, or how did that come about?
We were actually recovering from an interim ministry that my husband had been in before that, and just needed a safe place to go to church for a while. And I remember I couldn't even go into the worship service for a couple of months because the previous situation had been so damaging. So it was a safe place to just go back to for a while, and we didn't know how long we'd stay there. We just needed to kind of recover. So I think we were there for a couple of years. And then when my youngest started at school, Jamie, my husband, and I were sitting in service one day when the lead pastor said, you know, we've been praying about maybe putting on another staff member. And both of us had a feeling of like, this needs to be Mandy. So then he actually approached the pastor on my behalf and said, you know, the kids are going to be in school soon and Mandy's going to be free, because I was full-time at home with the kids at that time. And they basically just made a job for me then, I think.
And what was that job?
That was associate pastor and primarily overseeing the worship. I'm not a worship leader, but I was a worship curator. One of my books is about worship arts and creative worship approaches and stuff. So it was overseeing some of that stuff and organizing all the volunteers for worship services and doing some art shows in the cafe and stuff like that.
And so as you and I have certainly talked about before, you know, I came from the same restoration background, and I was out west, so it was maybe a little bit more open and progressive than maybe in Cincinnati especially. I don't know. I know Cincinnati is like the hot center of the restoration movement.
Yes.
What was that journey like for Cincinnati to call you as a woman to be the lead pastor of that, not Cincinnati, for university to call you to be the lead pastor of that church?
Yeah. The church had already decided to have women as elders and had a woman preach before. I think a previous children's minister who was a woman had preached once or twice. So it wasn't a huge step then to say, yes, we want to affirm her as a lead pastor. The more difficult thing was things going on outside of the church and connections there, since my husband also teaches at one of their Bible colleges. So there was some strife, and even just recently, a few months ago, there's been more strife. I'm the founder of the feminist movement within the restoration movement, apparently.
So wait, strife that he feels in his job or that you feel?
Both of us been personally targeted and had things written about us and said about us publicly. So he has felt it in the past in his where he teaches, not so much now, but it's been hard. And I think the hardest thing for me is just the broken relationships. There are real people who I love who I know don't approve of what I do. And even recently, one of the dearest women in my life passed away. And when I went to her funeral, in addition to grieving her loss, I grieved that she never specifically told me that she didn't approve of my role, but I could tell. I knew enough about her position on things to know when I stepped into this role that she was disappointed in me. And that kind of thing hurts more than when people who you don't know as well speak against you publicly. Yeah. So, yeah, there have been some hard things, but the church itself was very gracious. When it became apparent that I would be stepping into the lead role, we did have was really a weird day. There was, I knew it was important, but they had some conversations after the service one Sunday and had lunch to talk about, you know, what do we think about women in leadership. And so my co-lead at the time led some conversations around that. And I left because I wanted people to be able to talk honestly about that. But it was weird leaving and knowing the whole church was in there talking about women, but really thinking about me. And apparently that went quite well. The only, thing that was hard about that at the time was one couple did kind of say they didn't think I was ideal because I was a woman, but that they would pray for me and loved me and would stay at the church. But when you consider it, if that's the worst thing that happens, then I guess that's not too bad. Probably some of the other stuff that was really hard about that. So in general, the church itself embraced it, and I was so thankful for that, because if it had become about me being about my being a woman, then I would not have wanted to do it. I don't feel called to. Somebody actually asked me, "Have you always felt called to be a woman pastor?" And I was like, "Well, I didn't have much choice on the woman bit, but I have felt called to be a pastor. Like, I didn't want it to be about that."
Sure.
So I was thankful that it wasn't about that for most people in the church, and so that I could just get on with being a pastor. But the hardest part. But one of the hardest parts for me was getting over the baggage of my own self. Growing up in Australia, it really wasn't much of an issue. When you don't have many leaders, you don't have the luxury really to say, "But what about this?" So I didn't even think about that until I moved to this country. But going to Bible college here at a college that at the time was very conservative and didn't allow me into preaching classes and spent a lot of time telling me what I couldn't do. When you're hearing those things as a young person who's still trying to figure herself out, then it does cause some baggage. So I had to get over a lot of that stuff as I was stepping into the role.
Did it seem, other than exploring those conversations, was it, you mentioned co-pastor. So were you already in a, like a peer, two peers alongside each other leading the church role? And then when the other one moved on, you became the lead?
Yes. Yeah.
So was it almost an automatic thing, or did, other than people needing to process, you know, the question of you being a woman pastor, which you did not have a calling to be.
I never thought I'd be in this. No, I did not see myself. But that's probably because I'd never seen it done in a way that I could do it. I think if I had seen a woman like myself who was the lead pastor, I would have seen myself in that role. But if you imagine a businessman in a suit as a pastor, then of course I'd say, "Oh, no, that's not me."
So how have you learned how to do it?
Oh, my goodness, the hard way. giving myself a lot of grace. It actually has become the philosophy of my ministry that I cannot do this, actually. And the only way that it's possible is for me to acknowledge I can't do it and to call upon the Lord. And then his power is what's seen and not my own. And it's taken me a while to get used to being, to get used to not having shame in my limitation. I still feel the limitation and I still feel the pain of my limitation, but I'm learning more and more not to feel the shame of it, because the shame of it forces us to strive in our own strength and try to fill up what we feel is lacking. But when we don't have shame in the emptiness, then we can just turn to the Father and say, look how empty I am. You need to fill me. So that's the only way I've been able to do it.
Would this be a good time to talk about your book?
Oh, probably. I wasn't trying to lead into that.
Well, I've already got a note here, you know, ask Mandy about her book. So,
well, there you go.
Well, why don't you talk about your book? Because I feel like you're talking about your book.
Yes, that's, well, I mean, it's just all about that. It's called The Vulnerable Pastor. I think for me, you know, that often is wrapped up in Brené Brown kind of language. And I do reference her and I do love what she does. It's not for me, though, just about feeling vulnerable and saying things that make us feel exposed, but about what I was just talking about, really, about acknowledging that we are vulnerable as human beings, that we run out of ideas and we run out of energy and we, you know, our hearts break when hard things happen and we don't always understand and we get tired and all of the things that all human beings experience. And if we believe that God has given the church to human beings to run, then there must be some way for us to do it as human beings, if he is a good God. And that not only, and it's kind of interesting to think about it too, you know, if he could actually do anything better than we can do it, but for some reason he's called us into his mission. And so there must be something that he sees in us that he doesn't have. And I think it's our humanity. And he wants to embody himself just like he did in Jesus in us and let himself be seen through human lives, because he's trying to communicate to human lives. And so we are his language of communication. If we'll only let our humanity be seen and his power be shown through our humanity, then he can do amazing things. But I think we spend so much time trying to look strong, trying to impress each other and trying to look professional and, you know, trying to look successful, that we limit his ability to truly be seen. So that's kind of the main thing of the book. It begins with kind of personal stories and figuring it out on a very personal level, getting over all of my own baggage and shame and fears and confronting the emotions that are associated with that, but then sharing how I began to kind of let that leak with my staff and watched life break through for them. And then from there started to kind of experiment, I guess, with letting that be seen in my broader congregation. And honestly, it's the most fruitful thing I've ever seen, to let yourself be human in front of people. And it's been so amazing to me how the only times, you know, every pastor tries to do powerful things in the lives of other people for good, you know, with good motivation. The times when I've thought, man, I have this sermon so well written, I'm just going to wow the socks off of them, nobody's really that impressed. And the only times that people have used the word powerful are the times that I'm just a total mess. Either I have no idea what I'm talking about, because the vision that I have of God's love is so huge, I can hardly put words to it, or I am just so broken that I have to be in tears before people or be asking questions or just be seen in my brokenness. And that shows that it's not my power, because there is no power in me at that moment, and people say it's powerful. So this is not just about our personal wrestling, although it often begins there, but how God can use that in the way we lead our staff and in the way that we lead our church. And I think inevitably, as the church becomes more comfortable with its limitation, then we'll set aside all the ways that we try to look strong to the world and all the ways that we feel defensive and want to create institutions. And I believe that the world wants to see us needing God more than anything else. And so as we remember as human beings how to need God, then we will begin to shape a movement that is sharing that with the broader world. And I think that's when something significant will be seen in us.
Hmm. Yeah. Matt, what are you kicking around over there?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is all really rich, amazing stuff, Mandy. Would you be, I know you led a workshop at the Ecclesia gathering last week, mm-hmm. and yeah. I didn't get to go to that one, but it sounded, I had a friend who went, and it sounded like maybe there was a little bit of confusion about maybe the title of the workshop or mm-hmm. exactly what was happening in that space. But when my friend talked to me about it, it sounded just really, really unique and creative and kind of a different take on leadership than what I had been exposed to anyway. So mm-hmm. I thought it might be, if you'd be up for it, maybe talking for a few minutes kind of about that and, mm-hmm. you know, a synopsis of sorts of kind of what the workshop was about.
Yes, I'd love to. I started by talking about a campaign that the CEO of Facebook created with somebody from the Girl Scouts, I think, called Ban the Bossy. And I think it's a good idea without basically saying girls are usually raised being called bossy when they're being leaders and boys aren't called bossy. And so what does this do to our girls? And I definitely think there's something to that. But as I was exploring it, I didn't see any distinction being made between being a leader and being bossy. And I've actually had conversations with my daughter. There are times when she's bossy and being bossy is not really leading for the sake of the whole, but telling other people what to do. And so that was interesting to me right at the time that I was stepping into the lead pastor role, because I had a strange experience where two separate men approached me and said, I'm not actually comfortable with the idea of women in leadership of the church, but when I see how you do it, I'm comfortable with it. Hmm. And that made me think, how much is this cultural and how much is this scriptural? And perhaps those men had made some assumptions about what it means for a woman to lead. And so thinking about, you know, we are in the shadow of the women's movement, which has won so many wonderful things for women, but at the same time, it did set up a kind of us versus them mentality. And so many people assume that for a woman to lead, she has to be very driven and ambitious you know, trying to be masculine almost. And then to make the leap from that to church leadership, we would say, well, if that's what it takes for a woman to lead, and church Christian leaders shouldn't be like that, then women should never be Christian leaders. And so those comments from those men just made me think more about that whole question. And it took me back to when I was in college and being in a place when you're in your 20s and trying to figure out what you're going to do and being told all the things that you can't do obviously is very unsettling. And at the same time, my husband did a word study in his Greek class on the word in 1 Timothy, 2:12 or whatever, 13 maybe, the word hesychia, which is translated as silence or silent. And he was sharing with me how it doesn't necessarily mean vocal silence, but a peace, an inner peace. And the same root word is used at the beginning of the same chapter when it talks about praying for those who are in authority that we will have a quiet life. And so it's about a kind of a peacefulness. And it was so kind of ironic and strangely comical that this directive for peace was embedded in the very verse that was very disruptive to my peace. And as a college student, I remember thinking, well, if I need to have peace, I don't know how to have that yet, but I know it needs to look like peace, whatever it is. All I know is I don't have peace. And so I had to trust at that moment. And I remember going into this season of about 5 or 6 years in my 20s of just sitting in that tension of saying, I have to trust that the God in my heart and the God in the Bible and the God in the church are all the same God. I can't see how all those things come together yet and how my calling will flow from that, but I just have to trust and have and choose hesychia. And so the funny thing is, it's that decision to have that peace regardless that has actually qualified me for ministry, because I have a lot of reasons to not have hesychia. In my own wrestling with norms for women and in my own wrestling with real people who have said really horrible things to me. But the choice to have that deep peace that God is behind his church and his people, I see now when I was stepping into the role and those two men said to me, I don't believe women should do this, but when I see the way you do it, I think it's okay. What they saw was that choice to have a Heisukia. And so I published an article about based on this same idea once, and I was trying to be a bit cheeky, I guess, but I called it Bossy Women and the Bride of Christ. And the subtitle was How the World's Way of Leadership Has Seeped into the Church, hoping to catch people who understood that in the way that it sounds, which is, oh, feminism has seeped into the church. But instead, thinking about it in terms of how our ideas of what it means for anybody to lead have seeped into the church, that it means bossing people around, instead of the kind of servant leadership that Jesus shows. And then we just talked about, you know, what that looks like and how being a mother has actually helped me flesh that out in ways that nothing else has. And we read a passage from John about the shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And the same passage talked about his service to the sheep, his laying down of his life to them, and also his authority. And so we talked more about the word authority. We often talk about power and leadership, but we don't use the word authority very much, and how there is a kind of authority that comes from our submission to God, that when we've submitted ourselves to God's work in our own lives, we can speak with authority from that experience. And also when we have submitted ourselves to serving for the sake of others, as we do as parents, there's a kind of power and authority that comes from that too, when you're really seeking what is good for the other. So that's the shortest version I can make.
That's pretty concise.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. No worries. It was a wonderful workshop actually, and we had some really great conversations afterwards.
Mandy, how did you find the Ecclesia Network?
Oh my goodness. I was just thanking God for this the other day. I went to JR, actually a friend of mine went to JR Briggs's Epic Fail thing. It was one of the first ones, and she decided she wanted to bring it to Cincinnati, and I loved so much her description of it that I said, I'm going to help you make that happen here in Cincinnati. So I was like on the host committee before I even knew what it was. And so I met JR there, and this was really early in my, I think I was a co-leader still at the time, co-lead pastor still at the time. And so I was really wrestling with like fear of failure and stepping into doing something that I'd never seen a woman do in the way I need to do it. And, so they were looking for local people to share a brief story. It's a part of their Epic Fail thing that they'll have local people share as well. And so I had like a 10-minute thing where I shared my story a bit. And right afterwards, JR came up to me and said, I don't want to freak you out or anything, but how can we work together in the future? So I then started talking. I went to a few of his Epic Fail events to be one of the speakers. And then I think from there I got invited to be one of the speakers from at the Ecclesia Network National Gathering in 2014. So I felt welcomed in from there. They just like embraced me, and I just felt so at home being with all those folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So lots of churches become friends of Ecclesia. They learn about Ecclesia. They like Ecclesia. They come and hang out sometimes at things we do. But university decided we're going to be part of Ecclesia. What do you think made that? What closed the deal?
When I was filling out the application form, and they said something about give us some names for references of who you know already in the network, and I was like, forget that, I'm just going to make a long list of all the people. And then I made a little code of like, if there's an asterisk beside their name, that means I've been in their house, and if there's a I don't know, an X beside their name, that means I've been in their car, and if there's this beside their name, that means I've been to their church. And so it just almost didn't seem like, because I had already been to several different events and been welcomed by so many folks, and just had already got to know so many people. What sealed the deal? I think, well, there's just so many churches there that have so much in common with us, all being in, for the most part, kind of post-Christian contexts made a big difference for me. So many times when we go to events, you know, Christian resources type events, we just don't feel like the things that they're talking about would work for us. You know, if they say, like, when you plant your church, just send out 5,000 postcards and you'll get 500 people the first Sunday. We're just like, that's not happening for us.
Right.
And so I think that was a big part of it. The fact that it's so encouraging of women in leadership. Of course, that was really great for me. I loved the bringing together of practitioners and academics and of, you know, very thoughtful but spirit-led people. I don't see that happening very often, for those things coming together, and that was healing to my own heart because I've often felt like I had to be one or the other. And just this kind of immeasurable quality of wonderfulness in the people. You know, there's just, I guess I feel out of place a lot, whether I'm the only woman in the room or the only Australian in the room, or yeah, just the only artist in the room. I just often feel out of place, and there's not many places where that doesn't happen, and Ecclesia Network is one of those few places. So just found so many friends there and so many people that you can start at a certain level of conversation when there's so much that you have in common. You don't have to defend and explain everything. So that feels really good.
Yeah. I remember that. I'm sure I've told this story many times, but I remember the first time I was around some kind of ecclesia gathering. I'd been to a couple different church planning boot camps and conferences and all sorts of stuff, but I just remember sending a text to my wife that said, these are my peeps. You know, because it's just like there's no posturing, no pretense, and it just felt like, oh, let's just get down to it. Let's just talk about what we're all trying to figure out and learn. And yeah.
It's very human.
Yeah.
I don't feel like at a lot of conferences there's a lot of posturing or trying to impress one another, or if you just do this one extra thing, you'll be successful. And I actually said after this event, so many times when I go to things, conferences or workshops or whatever, there is a feeling of just be like me and you'll be cool and successful, or just change who you are, or, you know, there's just so many ways that it feels like a weight, whether just a download of too much information or a weight of performance. And I was just so moved at Ecclesia National Gathering last week because everything that I heard was saying, just keep doing what you're doing and we will be here. We're all doing it too. You know, so there was just, even in the workshops and main sessions, there were, of course, so many new ideas that I hadn't thought about and such a deeper level of it that I hadn't considered, but it was affirming of what I'm sensing God doing and not something for me to wrestle with one more time. I've done so much wrestling that I get tired.
Yeah.
So it was good to just be affirmed in what I'm sensing God doing in myself personally and in our staff and our congregation. I don't think you should have asked me the reason I'm in the network, because I just don't want to stop talking. There's like so many things that keep coming to mind. One last thing is, you know, I have 10 people on my staff and most of them are in their first ministries right out of college. And so I love them and they have so much energy and they're just such wonderful people. I hadn't realized how much I carry the weight of helping them through that initial stage of finding themselves in ministry. And some of them have mentors outside of the church, but still for the most part, it's on my shoulders. And when I brought my two associate pastors with me last week, I felt a weight lift. Not that I don't want it to sound like they're a burden to me, but just feeling like there is a community that's helping me develop them. And there are ways that other people in the network can encourage them or help them process an idea that's different from how I can. You know, I'm an older married woman and they're younger. Well, they're married too, but they're younger and they're husbands. I can't talk to them about what it's like to be a husband or what it's like to be a young man. So, I saw them both connect with people and really engage in ways that I trust those folks to lead them in the similar direction to what I'm doing, but in a way that is their own language. So that's a huge blessing to me.
Yeah. Well, Mandy, this is the target time we shoot for. So I know we could carry on this conversation for a long time and you'd have much to say, but we will respect your time and the average commute times of our listeners. I don't even know what that means. But you want to talk about if people want to keep up with the church's website or anything else? I can't remember. Do you have a blog? Do you blog at Missio a lot? But
Missio Alliance. Yeah. I don't have a blog of my own, but I write for Christianity Today, the new thing that they're doing, the local church. I'm doing some writing for them, and also Missio Alliance blog I'm writing for a lot. But that's probably the best way to keep up with us if somebody wants to do that.
And the church is universitychristianchurch.net.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mandy, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
It's great to hear the things you're kicking around and learn from you even while we're asking you questions.
Well, it's been good. It's been fun to chat.
Cool. Thanks, Mandy.
Take care.